very roots of eating, of negativity and singularity. Including the ultimate form of singularity, which is the world state of things, a pure bias without object and form. This is a typical bias of information. It's violent because what happens there is a murder of the real, the vanishing point of reality.
Let's not have a misunderstanding here.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Machinic Unconscious Happy Hour with Cooper Cherry and Taylor Atkins, as always, sponsored by the People's Institute for Revolutionary Semiotics. Before we introduce our guest today, we just want to mention we do have a Patreon account at patreon.com/MUHH. Consider tossing us a buck a month there. Today, we are proud to bring you all a conversation with John Greenaway, a.k.a. the LitCrit guy, writer, podcaster, content creator from the north of England, host of the Horror Vanguard podcast. He writes about horror, contemporary capitalism, and cultural theory. Today, we'll be discussing his book, A Primer on Utopian Philosophy, an introduction to the work of Ernst Bloch.
Nice. Nailed it.
To quote Bloch. I'll have to start out by quoting Darth Vader. The circle is now complete because I didn't mention this, but I had listened to a number of Horror Vanguard episodes. Kind of full circle, you know what I mean? So we're just glad to have you.
Thank you so much. Long time, first time. Super happy to be on the show. For people who don't know, my name's John. I am a podcaster as well. So I am the co-ghost of the Horror Vanguard.
Did you say co-ghost?
I did.
That's awesome. I love it. Go on.
We are a podcast dedicated to talking about horror movies and political theory and radical politics. We kind of joke on the show that it's about the three most important things. It's about, firstly, friendship. It's about communism. And if we have time, it's also about horror movies. And those are three very important things. If you like spooky shit, if you like theory and philosophy, please do check out Horror Vanguard, available wherever you get your podcasts from.
And we'll put that in the show notes. We'll link everything. We'll add links. And by the way, do you guys have a Twitter account? I didn't even know.
Yeah. We are on Twitter at Horror Vanguard. We're on SoundCloud, Patreon. Yeah, like say hello.
Probably so. I think so.
Let's see, Horror Vanguard.
I don't know. I haven't run that account in so long. I can't recall.
Yeah, I guess I'm running it now. I stole it from you. Horror Vanguard. We do follow each other. I guess I just hadn't put two and two together. So, but anyway, I know Coop, he gave you the heads up about our opening question. We want to know the origin story. You can tell us obviously how you got into podcasting along the way.
But, the elite world of podcasting.
Yeah. The elite, yes.
We decided really what the left needed was another podcast.
Okay, yes, exactly. But
that's what was needed.
But yeah, I mean, I dropped out of grad school, but I was in for comparative literature. And what I liked about the world of comparative literature is that you could do all the shit. You get to have your little toes in literature, in digital media, in movies, and whatever, culture broadly, but also you get to do the theory and philosophy stuff. So you get to, and psychoanalysis, you get to just play with every fucking thing. But I want to know about your background, your origin of sort of how you went down the route of, I'm not sure what your department would have been called, but you can tell us that along the way in your origin story.
Like many people, I finished my undergraduate degree when capitalism went through one of its periodic massive periods of crisis. And so looked at the world and was like, hey, maybe I should just stick around and do a master's degree. And I did what was at the time the only taught master's degree in Gothic literature in the UK. And then I decided that this was a thing that kind of caught my interest. And I ended up going to the Manchester Centre for Gothic Studies, which is one of the premier research institutions for Gothic and horror studies in the world. Did a PhD on 19th century English and American Gothic literature. And along the way, kind of sparked an interest in theory, particularly, honestly, the person who probably got me into theory properly is Terry Eagleton, the British Marxist writer, who is a great gateway point for the history and the development of this tradition of thought I actually have two books coming out this year. There's this one, which is quite short, and there's a longer one that's coming out in a few months' time called Capitalism, a Horror Story, Gothic Marxism, and the Dark Side of the Radical Imagination. I wrote both of them out of this kind of idea that like horror as a cultural form has often been a kind of source of hope for people. People find it kind of like a comforting, hopeful thing. That philosophical question is kind of like interesting to me. So I think some people think about writing about horror and hope as like contradictory, but I actually think they're two very complementary traditions. And I found the work of Ernst Bloch. And if you follow me on Twitter for like the past 2 or 3 years, you'll know that this is basically all I've been talking about, mostly because there's so much of it. So, and comparatively, quite a lot of it is still untranslated. Bloch's book on Hegel is not translated. Das Materialismus Problem. Many of his kind of big, substantial volumes in his complete works in German have not been translated into English. But what has been translated forms this incredibly engaging, incredibly kind of, it's very charismatic writing. And I sort of fell into it pretty hard. And I think everyone's had this experience of finding a thinker, finding a writer from the history of a tradition of thought that you're interested in that suddenly kind of unlocks a door for you. It's like walking through a great house and you open the door and there's all of these kind of rooms and other aspects of it that you've never noticed before. And that's what reading Bloch has been like. But Bloch is not easy to approach, especially for someone like me who is not formally credentialed as a philosopher. I don't have the grounding that some people do, but I feel like that creates barriers for people. So it's a very short, almost pamphlet length book that is deliberately titled A Primer, because a primer is the beginning of something. I'm not trying to present the definitive English reading of Bloch's philosophy. That would be a much longer book. And there is plenty of quite sophisticated academic philosophy. I acknowledge the work of a kind of small circle of Anglophone scholars, Kat Moyer, Frederick Jameson, Vincent Geoghegan, Wayne Hudson. And the person who introduced me to Bloch is Peter Thompson. And I think it's very important that people kind of know that. But like Bloch is this incredibly dynamic thinker. And so the last year or so, I put together this primer, mostly as a way for myself, firstly, to try and kind of like find a way into this great corpus of work that stretches across basically 50 years of the 20th century. And so this is one way into that.
There was a question you had, or there was a, you posed this, this seeming question of reception, right? Whether or not Ernst Bloch is philosophical enough for Marxism today, or I'm not exactly sure how you framed it. I think he is, from the little bit that I got to read this week, you know, not just obviously the monumental 3 volumes of The Principle of Hope, skimming through volume 1 of that, but I mentioned to you that I was interested in his book on Avicenna and the Aristotelian left. And I think that that type of investigation, seeing in matter something that, well, I mean, the way that the intro, I'm not sure if it's written by Thompson or not. I have to go back and look. The way that the intro, the translator's introduction, I thought laid it out well, and I'm sure that Bloch goes over it himself, where like, you know, on the Aristotelian right, form is active, matter is passive, and the two marry and they go do their thing and they make stuff. For Bloch, and for someone that I mentioned that I'm interested in, why I've spent years translating him, Simon Don, this type of hylomorphic scheme is very much informed by the politics of the time with a kind of master-slave dynamic. You know, the master gives orders, commands, like form, supposedly the active one, and the slave carries out the orders and therefore passive like matter. But so it makes sense to me right off the bat in this understanding, this kind of this left Aristotelian understanding of matter as having active dynamic principles. I think from there, you've already got a nice little sort of philosophically charged and politically informed understanding of a sort of basic philosophical schema. And for me, I was sold right away that like, okay, I kind of like this guy. And you can derive from this notion of a sort of activity inherent in matter a little bit of what you spend time on in your primer discussing, which is whether it be this principle of the not yet or this sort of futural aspect of hope and its anticipatory dimension. I know that wasn't even a fucking question. I was just thinking through this notion of the corollary of what you said about him not being philosophical enough was this style that you mentioned, mm-hmm. right? This literary style, which I do think comes up in a lot of his books, right? These little, you wouldn't really call them aphorisms, but these sort of aphoristic type, epigrammatic, if you will, bookends or little beginnings to some of the chapters you see in a lot of his works. So that's just one aspect that I think differentiates him from more straight-laced type philosophical writing.
I try and avoid quite a lot of technical, proper philosophical language in this primer. There's a footnote to something that Adorno says about philosophy freed from the tyranny of method. For the life of me, I actually can't remember where I found this, but there's this quote of Adorno talking about finding Geist der Utopia, the spirit of utopia, Bloch's, one of Bloch's very early books. Mm-hmm. And it's this kind of leather-bound brown book that looks like it's just fallen out of like a German fairy tale, is what Adorno says. And it was a reminder that you can do philosophy freed from the tyranny of method. And the thing about Bloch that I think is, it should be of interest to people who maybe don't count themselves as like in the world of philosophy, is that he sees philosophy as intimately bound up with human existence in its totality. Johann Sievers has this great article about Bloch where he talks about philosophy kind of retreats into this scholastic discourse of reference and kind of like an internal language. And as Sievers puts it, he says, we could say that critique has become uncritical because it's been disengaged from the actual kind of stuff of human life, and for Bloch, particularly human imagination. And it's like, that's the ground from which philosophy emerges for Bloch. Things like, you know, Strasbourg Cathedral or listening to Beethoven or Wagner. He writes in The Spirit of Utopia, he writes very beautifully about music. And this question of style is that he is, elsewhere I've described it as philosophy as literary modernism. It is often extremely referential. Concepts in Bloch, he doesn't do the correct philosophical thing of explaining in detail the concept before the concept is deployed. Concepts are deployed often. He likes Latin quite a lot as well. And these concepts kind of get worked out in the process of going through a book. So to read Bloch is, you kind of spend a lot of time at first going, what the hell is this guy on about? Like, where is any of this going? And then you, by the end of the book, you arrive in this place, which is kind of like intellectually and emotionally and experientially very deep compared to just immediately picking something up and seeing it as kind of like, kind of transparent knowledge. I think it's a good sign. You know, it's something Gillian Rose writes about.
In that way, right? You're unfolding instead of merely declaring your...
Yeah. And of course, concepts in Bloch's work are kind of linked on the subterranean level between books. So the not yet, for example, is one of his key concepts. And there's like at least three or four different ways that that concept can be deployed. Reading Bloch is, at first, it's like this exercise in bafflement. And maybe there'll be people who kind of bounce off it quite hard because of that. But the hope of this primer is that you go, actually, this is all coherent. And this is not just obscurantist nonsense, but it's actually quite, this is this sort of enormously exhilarating experience. If you pick up one of Bloch's books, I think he does like these very small aphoristic statements at the beginning. You know, Heritage of Our Time opens with, or is it The Principle of Hope, which opens with, I am, we are, that is enough. Now we have to begin. And by the end of it, you've gone through this entire kaleidoscope of ideas and images and concepts that kind of come together at the end to form something really compelling. And I think it's a really good example of marrying form and content. The content of what Bloch is trying to do demands a particular form.
You know, not all of his work is merely ornamentation or something like that, right? Like, not that any of this is ornamentation, but I'm saying, like, for those who might levy that charge, I mean, I was talking to you earlier about his book on Karl Marx, and it looks, for the most part, like a traditional type of exposition. And the same with the book on Avicenna that I just mentioned. There are multiple avenues into his work. Mm. You know, it is sad, as I told you, I would need some sort of drill instructor to force me through the three volumes of The Principle of Hope, because that is, I think you wrote in your primer, 1,600 pages or so, right? You know, that is a monumental undertaking. Some of the other books are of human size. You know, they're not extraordinary. So there is ways into his work. And a decent amount I was able to find and get my hands on. But as you mentioned, I mean, you told me that you had you yourself had translated some of his work on a thinker I wasn't familiar with, but that seems pretty essential to his work. Didn't you? Are you planning on finishing the whole?
So one of his early books is called Thomas Münzner, Theologian of the Revolution, which is just a great title, even in English.
Yeah.
And is about the German peasant wars during the Reformation, and is kind of integral, I think, to understanding Bloch's later book, Atheism and Christianity. And in fact, it's Bloch's entire kind of philosophical approach to the question of religion, full stop. I think it's quite timely. There's a new Münzner biography that's just come out from Gusto. It's a very complicated thing because the language that he uses is often quite idiosyncratic, precisely because he is this kind of... The three big reference points for his philosophy are Marx, Hegel, and Goethe. It's a long process, but I would love to try and get through the entire thing. If I, you know, like you say, if I had like a drill instructor or a sergeant who'd make me do nothing but that for 6 months.
It's good that we brought this up, or that in the course of talking about this, we brought up the role of theology in Bloch's work, because pre-show talk, I mentioned I've always been curious where Zizek got the idea of this kind of Christian atheism. And it's clear he stole it straight from Bloch. What I was intrigued about, and I think you describe it at the end of your primer as a kind of this transcendent dimension without transcendence. And so it is kind of post-death of God, if you will. I think you may mention death of God in passing, right? Which I'm sure I think maybe you even quote Atheism and Christianity, where Bloch's talking about. It's this question of a theological dimension that isn't sort of centered around God as lawgiver or something like this. I mean, that's a broad way of stating it, but maybe we could talk a little bit more about this dimension and how it dovetails into his political commitments, which, spoiler alert for the listener, is deeply Marxist, if you hadn't guessed. So maybe we can talk a little bit about that interest. I was really struck by the way that you describe it as like the cold stream and the warm streams of Marxism, and how maybe Bloch is really trying to point us to get a little bit more warmth.
That's actually probably a really good place to start. Bloch talks about there are these two... To call them like traditions is a little bit kind of reductive, I think, but there are these two sort of tendencies in the history of thought towards liberation. And you have, on the one hand, you have the prophetic denunciation of the present and the announcing of the new, right? The kingdom of God is at hand. Right. That is like liberatory speech acts into the present that aim to instantiate a future kind of state here and now. You can put into that tradition all of the kind of like religious critiques of capitalism or society. You can put into that tradition sort of the utopian socialists of the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries. But at the same time, Bloch also highlights there is the science of historical materialism, because he's often characterized, Habermas writes about him and calls him like a Marxist Schelling, sort of like pre-critical. He's not done his Kant. He's not just this kind of like prophetic, romantic figure, even though that is irreducibly part of his makeup. He also highlights that there is the science of historical materialism. There is like the logic and attention to cold material conditions that have to be, he puts it in The Principle of Hope, you know, this sort of future facing utopianism, this kind of warm stream of Marxism, it needs lead poured into its shoes. You're right. It has to be brought down into the to the earth, because without it, what you get is you get, as he calls it, Jacobinism, you get fanaticism, which instead of liberation, you'll have like a vicious, bloody, violent revenge upon the world. And he says, actually, but if all you have is the science of historical materialism, if all you have is this cold, unimaginative Marxism, you'll have something that gets lost in the kind of like fog of revisionism and eventually kind of like irrelevance from a political struggle. So those two things are really important. And actually, it's a good way of explaining, I think it's a little reductive, but it's a good model for understanding the debate he has with his one time extremely close friend, the Hungarian philosopher Georgi Lukács. The two of them were inseparable for a very long time. If you read Lukács' early work after reading Bloch, you'll see that the two of them are kind of like hand in hand for a very long time. Lukács is a much more kind of orthodox Leninist in lots of ways. He eventually says that actually Bloch has kind of lost. He's become a pseudo-religious figure. is kind of deviated right. from the true path. And this culminates in their debates around artistic expressionism, which is collected in the very useful volume Aesthetics and Politics from Verso. So Bloch says actually that a dearth of imagination is incredibly dangerous because you end up, the collective cultural imagination is a political space. And if, as he writes about it in Heritage of Our Time, if there is no kind of communist imagination, then fascism will be happy to kind of fill that gap and to kind of give you a political program that speaks to the needs and wants and desires and dreams of every single level of society. He's not someone who believes in this idea of like a transcendent God as the ultimate patriarch, the guy in the sky who will determine what's right and what's wrong. It's a fair criticism is that he is, like many of that generation, committed to a kind of telos of Marxism, a teleological Marxism where you go, eventually it's, you know, it'll come good. But this is someone who lived and wrote through the Russian Revolution and, you know, was, in fairness, was kind of almost criminally slow to recognize Stalinism post 56, but there are kind of intellectual reasons for that. So he's not someone who believes in this kind of like transcendent reality. He is a materialist. And he says that only a Christian can be a good atheist and only an atheist can be a good Christian, because it's about taking this kind of like the kind of the rational kernel at the heart of this mystical idea of religion. That rational kernel is, as he puts it in Atheism and Christianity, is about the movement from bondage to liberation. That is the great story of religion, is the move towards utopia. Does it have to be framed in eschatological terms? No, it doesn't, because that it requires taking on all of this non-materialist philosophical baggage. Actually, the way in which you, as I put it in the primer, the way in which you communize the eschaton, right, is you do it collectively and politically. This is what he means when he says that only an atheist can be a good Christian. It's only once you've gotten rid of this non-materialist baggage that you can actually have the political instantiation of the utopian kernel that resides in the religious dream.
And I think that the way that Peter Thompson writes, and because I believe it is, and if I remember correctly, I believe it is Peter Thompson's intro to Atheism and Christianity, where he sort of develops this idea, which I think he's borrowing from another author who I can't remember, but this idea of it's the God of Exodus. If there is a God in Bloch, it's this God of moving out of bondage, fleeing Egypt and whatnot. I thought that was a kind of helpful way of doing it. And he ends his intro, you know, kind of saying, in order to reach utopia, you've got to go through the desert, but why be so modest to stop at utopia or something like this, right? I appreciate the way that you highlighted this. And I do think that it's easy enough. Okay, there's two things. I guess one, on the one hand, it seems like the emphasis is still on the famous Marx quote about religion as the opiate of the masses or something like this, right? Now, obviously, the rest of the quote gets forgotten because it's also heart of a heartless world, the soul, you know, the et cetera, right? There is a sense in which he's not just announcing religion, but sometimes the emphasis seems like religion is still combated because there is still these fundamentalisms, right, that have not only, even as it seems like there are less worshippers, there's a backlash, right? And there's that just seems like the return of the repressed or something like this. But it does feel like, on the other hand, Bloch is making up for this. You can't just throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? There is, as you said, this rational kernel of religion or of theology. Gosh, I forget again. I'm trying to remember. Maybe it's Bloch himself who kind of goes into the etymology of religion as this rebinding, but he weaves it into this narrative, this futural narrative of the not yet, the utopic. As you were saying, is this call for reawakening imagination? And I think that's why, you know, philosophically for Bloch, at least philosophy begins with wonder, right? Like a true wonder that doesn't merely fade with knowledge. And I thought that was an interesting way of putting it. You know, I mean, obviously it's a very old tale, and it's not just the wonder at that there's something rather than nothing, right? It's the wonder that there is this inherent possibility, maybe what Deleuze would call the virtual or something, you know, because I do see ties there. Won't go into that particularly, but this wonder that there is this not yet inherent in the something that calls for sort of dynamically unpacking it. I hate to use that word. This is a word that we learned probably in fucking, you know, literature classes, but there's still a lot more to be unpacked, right? Almost like, you know, hope at the bottom of Pandora's box, right? There's still a little bit more to be unpacked.
Probably one of the first kind of English language introductions to Bloch is in Fred Jameson's book from the 70s called Marxism and Form, which has an entire section on Bloch's work. And he says that, like, it's not just that for Bloch, Simon Critchley says that philosophy begins in disappointment. And Jameson's right to say that, like, philosophy begins in not just wonder, but astonishment in the face of existence. But you're quite right to say that that's not enough, because it's not just, isn't it incredible that there is something? What could this become? There's a great Bloch kind of epigrammatic saying of, like, Genesis lies at the end, not the beginning.
I like that.
I like that a lot.
You put that in your book.
Where he says that actually, you know, just because something starts necessarily involves something having to end. And the end of something is actually the precondition for something new to emerge. He also says that, like, matter is not just this inert lump. There is this kind of, like, unfolding dynamic process that is a sort of principle of existence for Bloch, that matter has an entelechy. There is movement within the stuff of the world. And that's not just a kind of political problem, but it's a sort of existential principle as well. But this is why I think his interest in religion is worth paying attention to, because I think quite a lot of the time debates about religion Marxists just go, well, even if you say people who are religious do good things, it's not going to exist anyway. And Bloch would go, well, that's a kind of very idealist projection. You're just thinking that you can abolish. You have to understand that in the present, it's a political problem, and how these political forces develop is not simply something that can be abolished by kind of like fiat. I think just on a kind of objective level, even if you go, well, this is a sociological problem that we have to understand and engage with. But Bloch is, I think Heritage of Our Time is a really good book to read if you're interested in, along with Atheism and Christianity, because he talks about this in the concept of fascism, where at the time the critique of fascism was, well, it's just a kind of deceit of ideology. And Bloch goes, no, you've massively underestimated this. He calls fascism the kind of swindle of revolution, because it's promising something that is not being, there is this kind of vacant space. He was a very strong proponent of the United Front against fascism. This kind of arid materialism, as he refers to it, is a dead end. It takes you nowhere.
You know, if it were merely ideology, for Deleuze and Guattari, I mean, in Anti-Oedipus, they follow Reich. If it were merely that the masses were tricked, it's interesting because it's not just deceit. I like swindle because what's at stake is desire, right? When you buy into a charlatan's promise, it is based on desire and not some sort of misapprehension of truth or something like this, right? It's not just a sort of mistaken imaginary reality conflation in a sort of Althusserian notion of ideology. It's playing off of desire. It's that fascism is desired, and that's the real problem. It's not just some sort of illusion or mere illusion. It's more like delusion in the way they think of it, delirium.
Yeah, because it's not simply a matter of facts. It's not this kind of these sets of empirical claims that, you know, masses are convinced by. There are these kind of imaginative, or again, to put it in Deleuzean terms, these issues of desire and these points of desire which are fed and kind of like have something drawn out from them. And Bloch understood that kind of untapping of imagination and desire, even down to the level of daydreams, as he writes about at the very beginning of The Principle of Hope, that is politically important. That is ground that you cannot afford to give up.
I saw you put that in the notes, this notion of daydreams. It is interesting. And I think you go over this towards the end of your primer, right? Where it is this question of, not to stick with those terms, but it is a question of desire. And I like what you said earlier about, you know, if we give up on this warm stream of, we can call it liberation theology or something like this, however we want to describe it, if we give up on that, that's where fascism can come in. And with its promises, you use that, fill that stream. And so, yeah, you can't see ground in your desire. No, that's Lacan. Let's not bring him in. I'm just kind of fascinated with this because I do feel like there is sometimes a tendency to, and this goes back to to Thomas More, right? Utopia is this play off of a good place and a no place. And I think that there is a way in which utopian, almost this notion of utopia, is almost a pejorative. It's almost, and I think that that's how Thomas More obviously meant it. Block, you know, I think he doesn't want to see that ground. He almost wants to like reappropriate it and like rehabilitate the term.
Adorno famously says, you know, Block is the thinker who's restored honor to utopia as a philosophically and politically coherent idea. I think maybe people who are not in the world of philosophy kind of come across utopia as like, oh, it's naive. It's this idea of like, when you're very young, you go, why is it that some people are poor and don't have enough food to eat? And you go, well, when you grow up, you realize there are reasons for this. It's impossible. You know, don't be so naive. Don't be such a utopian. And actually, Block is like, actually, those questions are important.
Yeah.
And are expressing a kind of very, very like astute insight into the condition of the world that we live in. Block paid very careful attention to things like idle questions or like your dreams or the things that you kind of feel like you're missing in your life. Because he was like, well, that tells you something about the kind of broader philosophical conditions that people live under. In many ways, so much of his work is like, if everything unfolds as it could, not as it will, but as it could, we will get to a point where we can be kind of human beings for the first time. Not because of some sort of like biological essentialist idea of what that's supposed to be like, but simply because like the systems of existence that so many people labor under, he puts it like, we don't feel at home in the world. Utopia is Heimat in German. This idea of like the place at which you are at home. You are no longer kind of subject to all of these deprivations, to all of these stresses, to all of these kind of anxieties and the things that you don't have. This is why his attempt to ground hope as something more than just a subjective feeling requires this kind of like ground up reconstruction of a philosophical basis for it.
This is really interesting to me, starting to get into his work through your primer, because, you know, I remember, and I couldn't find it, and I didn't try too hard, but I remember Nietzsche in one of his works, who knows if it's Daybreak, could be Gay Science, but he has one of his little takes about hope, and, you know, he denounces it. But if you look through the rest of his work, and what I found looking through the rest of his work is that he doesn't, I think he means it in the way that Block would mean it in terms of, and this is how you open your work, in terms of what we might think of as a kind of blind optimism. I have in the notes, we're looking at it now, but yeah, optimism, which would be naive, is this belief in the present that things will work out. And I think that that's the kind of hope that Nietzsche is thinking about, because it is, for Nietzsche, and again, I have to go find the passage, when he's denouncing it, this naive optimism, it's almost like a swindle. It's like a self-swindle, like you're deluding yourself. And I think this may be your quote as well. Hope is the philosophical counterpart to the political project of utopianism. I guess that would be the question of this notion of hope, this concept that seems like it's essential for understanding this, the concrete utopia that Block is trying to gesture towards.
The distinction that's really useful to pick up on is the difference between hope and optimism. I'm not a very optimistic person, but I am hopeful. And I think optimism, it has a kind of intellectual and political passivity to it, because it kind of goes, well, if we just do our bit and the system generally works itself out for the good anyway, right? We can be optimistic now that we have done electoralism or whatever, those kind of subjective moments of political experience are, right? That's often quite optimistic. That's fine, but it's incredibly limited. And as you say, it's probably quite naive. But like, hope is, you know, this is something I say in the primer, hope is actually hard. And if you want to take it seriously, requires this sense of like agential capacity. Are there latencies or possibilities or tendencies within the present that mean that things do not always have to be the way that things are? And I think the answer to that is yes, right? This is, but how to harness those and how to catalyze them, as it were, is a very complicated question that immediately takes you into very practical questions of like strategy and organization. And, you know, to circle back to those questions that maybe like really young children ask, why do some people have to exist in poverty? Oh, don't be so naive. Actually, if you take that question very seriously, you suddenly go, oh, the entire world has to be fundamentally, qualitatively, and quantitatively different in order to make sure that that doesn't happen. Tom Moylan has a real, says that that's the crux of being a utopian, is to understand the necessity of this qualitative break in the mode of life. To be a utopian is to, I think it's a quote I've heard somewhere that's like, communists are refugees from the future. You've come back from a time when you didn't have to be a communist. There is this idea that like you are disengaged from what is, in some ways, not accepting its naturalization, with the idea that actually that disengagement is the first step of kind of recognizing something can be different. Moylan uses the really useful pairing of denunciation and enunciation. There is the kind of philosophical denouncing of what is, the ruthless criticism of all that exists. But that is really the only first half of that equation, because it's also about the kind of, you know, China Mavel in his new book on the Communist Manifesto talks about the prophetic speech act, that philosophy written in the future tense of, you know, not what is, but what could be. That's the other half of it. That's the enunciation. And both of those things have to be held in this constant productive tension.
No, I like that. And I guess that helps to sort of see where or why Bloch is such a committed communist, considers himself that to be the other side of the denunciation of what is, because it is still, I'm trying to remember the Badiou quote. I think it's in Metapolitics where, you know, it's easy, and this maybe gets to some of how Bloch looks at the dimension of the past as having these unexplored possibilities as well, right? It's easy to look at the French Revolution, for example, and merely see terror, or look at the October Revolution and see Stalin, right? Or something like this, right? It's easy to, and Deleuze gets into this in the Abecedaire in his little video interview, when he talks about, from the vantage point of history, of course, revolutions are going to appear this way, right? History is written in this major mode where it's going to not be able to articulate or enunciate, as you just said, this becoming revolutionary that is sort of counter to history. And so I can see there's a way in which, and I didn't even get to the Badiou quote, but I think for Badiou, the you know, it's kind of the real communism never been tried or something like this. But for him, it's that, you know, the outcomes of communism in the past don't exhaust its essence.
Yeah,
right.
Precisely. I mean, this is why Bloch is kind of, in many ways, someone who so many other Western, particularly German intellectuals, are writing like against or with. Adorno is incredibly invested in Bloch's work. Brecht is, Siegfried Krakauer, the kind of big touch point in what you're talking about here is Walter Benjamin. Bloch and Benjamin, I think, understood each other very well, even though in many ways they are these kind of like inverse operations that are happening. They're both attracted to this idea that actually the question is not like what is history, but what are all of the other things that history could have been? Mm. And history does not run on railway tracks where like it was always going to lead from point A to point B. There are all of these kind of temporal moments, these ruins, these fragments, Bloch refers to Spuren, traces of things that are left in the kind of, in the very fabric of history that are useful. And, you know, there's Benjamin's famous phrase that we don't say that they have kind of like truth content, but they provide this profane illumination of the situation. And I think this is entirely congruent with what you're saying of like, was it all predetermined? And it's a classic anti-communist argument, right? The October Revolution was always already Stalinist. That was always the only way that it was ever going to end up. Bloch ended up in actually quite a lot of difficulty and trouble with the political structures of the DDR, precisely because he insisted on the necessity of kind of like this rethinking of materialism, of like engaging with religion, of engaging with culture, and like fostering this kind of like what he would call a kind of polyphonic dialectics. And he ended up on the other side of the Berlin Wall, where he was seen as like, he was, you know, either a kind of Stalinist, or he was someone who was a bit of a joke. And in the East, he was this dangerous revisionist. He was far too liberal and far too open to new things. So yeah, I think this idea of like, this is another way in, it's like thinking about the philosophy of history. You know, what does it mean to say that the past has brought us to this point? And there are aspects of which, there's a really famous quote from Bloch where he says that not all people live in the same now. We are temporally disjointed despite the great effort of the capitalist revolution to kind of naturalize itself. In some ways, this is a very traditional Marxist idea, right, of combined and uneven development of the productive forces. But like Bloch is interested in how does that uneven development, how does that feel to live through? And what does that mean about the relative, like, different layers of the social fabric? Not all of us live in the same now. There are, as he puts it, he talks about kind of Gothic art and German villages where like Egypt is the land of pharaohs. That's what it is now, but that's not the same now that everybody else lives in. And what this means is that history is there in some sense is kind of like unfinished. It's unfinished business. And what that highlights, even if only in a negative sense, so is the future. This is great quote from Bloch where he says that, like, as long as, you know, existence is not this kind of like totally closed off, completely sealed totality, as he puts it, no objection to utopia can be raised on purely factual grounds.
Right. I was talking with Coop earlier. We were texting, and Coop, you brought up Nietzsche's notion of the powers of the false. And I was trying to articulate, obviously that's a compliment and a good thing, but I was trying to articulate how perhaps Bloch would not necessarily like that language of utopia or hope as false, but even in a positive sense, but perhaps the notion of counterfactual would fit. And so I like how you just phrased it, right? That arguing on the basis of the factual is never going to be able to foreclose the dimension of utopia because it precisely is positing a counterfactual.
I think that's the way in. And that there's a very famous article by Jürgen Habermas about Bloch, which kind of links Bloch and Nietzsche as two thinkers who are relatively sympathetic to each other in some ways. And he talks about Bloch is the philosopher of carpe diem, of seizing the day. And he says that the kind of promise of carpe diem can only be fulfilled when amor fati has been shaken off. It's only when you know, this idea of going back to the gay science of the eternal recurrence, like the world as it is, being this thing that you're willing to not just tolerate, but love. But it's like, actually, the world as it is a dangerous foreclosing of the world as it could be, which is the kind of Blochian twist on the Nietzschean idea. What we love is not the world as we currently have it. It's this idea of like, well, where could all of this go?
It is interesting. And I guess this is the dimension of the not yet. I mean, you mentioned this earlier in leading up, but I guess we could go back to it. This notion of the not yet. I know that one of the ways that it is proposed is the not yet conscious, which I thought was interesting. And even though there are perhaps dimensions of this in, for example, Freud's notion of the unconscious and the conscious pre-conscious system, blah, 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 I think that it is interesting. I thought about it a little bit, and perhaps it's right. Don't want to judge anything too much yet on this. But anyway, I was thinking about how I like this notion of an unconscious turn toward the future. And I crib that straight from Guattari's book, The Machine of Unconscious, where he's kind of arguing that we have the unconscious we deserve. And what he means by that, and I've seen people sort of ask, like, what could he mean by this? And I think that what he means by this, since he leaves it as almost a provocative void to be filled, is, you know, based on conditions on the ground and on how we orient our understanding of desire on that populates the machine of unconscious as he sees it, that's the unconscious we deserve. So we can be locked into the present. We can be locked into a blind optimism, or we can be locked into merely investigating sort of, let's say, the childhood primal scene, like in Freud, right? It's always, it does seem like it's always the dimension of the past that is accentuated in Freudian psychoanalysis. But I do think that the not yet conscious harbors something that is this, you know, question of unlocking possibilities that perhaps seem to be foreclosed based on the status quo or opinion or whatnot. And it's that kind of critique that, again, seems to form these alliances with Bloch and these other thinkers. Because I think that's the question is, and what I think your primer does pretty well is try to orient the reader in a way that you can see continuities with Bloch's work and other thinkers.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, my hope is that people will go, actually, again, there are ways in here. If you accept Locke's ideas about the philosophy of history, this is or the philosophy of thought even, as kind of intellectual tradition, here is this great set of works, these kind of like this great, Jameson calls it like a satellite that's fallen out of the sky, covered in these kind of like great hieroglyphs that you don't yet kind of know. But actually there are keys here. I really like the fact that like in so much of what we've talked about, you've been connecting it to like Deleuze and Bourdieu and this wider philosophical tradition of which Locke is either tacitly or not kind of engaged with. And then the not yet is something, it's true. He's quite dismissive of Freud and he's extremely dismissive of Jung.
There's reason to be suspicious of Jung, even if, you know, he turned away later. There's maybe a little bit more than flirtation with being a Nazi.
Locke famously refers to him as the psychoanalytical fascist, is just a good burn. But like his kind of principal problem is that they are constantly turning towards the past. You know, he puts it in quite a poetic way, actually, where he says that Freud is interested in night dreams, the dreams of night, where, you know, when you're older, you always think backwards to what could have been as a child. Because really, for Locke, the opposite of hope is not fear. The opposite of hope is memory. Because memory traps you in the past and hope is the philosophy of the future. So he says, actually, he's far more interested in the dreams of the day because he says this is what the young people do. You know, when you're working at the job that you hate, you kind of dream, you drift away and you think about, well, what would I be doing if I didn't have to work in this? And he's like, well, that's interesting because that's the kind of psychology of a futurity. What is not yet is not just this kind of like personal, psychological or existential concept. It's also a political one. There is this idea of developing class consciousness. He was asked when he was kind of an old man, how would you sum up your philosophy? And he says, S is not P. S is not, like these things have not yet become this idea of like the development of productive forces, the development of like revolutionary classes in and of themselves among the working classes. All of these things are the things which are not yet or have not yet begun. There's some interesting ambiguities in using the original German language because it doesn't necessarily translate directly in a way that captures all of the things that Locke is trying to talk about. As I put it in the primer, I was just looking for a page there. Locke is like looking backwards simultaneously as he's looking forwards. The figure of Janus is someone I talk about quite a lot because I think it's very linked to this idea of like a Marxist philosophy of history that sees the past as incomplete. Jameson says that like the point of a philosophy of history shouldn't be to kind of find out what really happened, but actually to kind of radically destabilize what we think has happened and to uncover all of these like moments of possibility that were either foreclosed or were kind of blocked by conditions. So the not yet is an incredibly useful concept as it kind of scales up from the individual up to, you know, even the uncertainty and the endpoint of the universe itself, of matter has its own not yet.
Funny you bring that up. I was looking at the hypothetical endings of the universe, and there are more than I had imagined. There's like five or six that are popularly imagined. You know, obviously there's like a big crunch. There's ways that they can rip and all this shit. And I was like, I was really fascinated with this cosmological schemata about the death of the universe. But yeah, that is a great way of sort of tying back into this the quote unquote left Aristotelian notion of this sort of inherent possibilities in matter. I like that making that cosmological point. That's a
And like you may not, people listening may not accept like this. You might kind of go, well, this sort of ontological incompleteness, this like unfolding of matter, how does that really affect anything? But like the great thing about Locke's argument is that it never demands kind of fidelity to the entire thing, because his entire kind of like methodology is about seeing this operation of a kind of utopian unfolding principle operating across so many things that no matter where you turn, you know, are you interested in literature and art? You'll find it there. You know, he famously says, like, all there is Hegel and Karl May. Everything else is this pure admixture. You know, do you like music? You'll find it there. Do you like a political struggle? You'll find it there. Do you like these speculations about the endpoint of the universe itself? Like, you'll find it there if you are willing to look for it. He has this tradition of renegade, sort of like heretical philosophers Aristotelian Left book is a really good example of like the genealogy that he places himself in. Joachim of Fiore, Burma, like Leibniz, this kind of like heretical tradition of philosophy, which again, perhaps is another good connection to Deleuze.
This notion of being a heretic is really interesting. I'm just remembering this is kind of how Larouel discusses heresy. You know, for him, philosophy is always, at least the history of philosophy, it's always seemingly schismatic. There's a schism. So there's a break from a previous sort of dominant order, but the schism always reinstitutes a type of sect or church, if you will, schools, as we might call them in philosophy, that still proclaims to be the correct path. That's precisely how the schismatic break works. There's a truer path that needs to be followed and we will establish it. And heresy isn't necessarily about that kind of break. It's a more radical break in a certain sense.
I think that's true. I think there's this idea of like, that what something might mean is not just given. Existence is not just this thing which is given to you. This is the great kind of argument against utopia. Things are the way they are. And Block kind of just flatly rejects this as kind of philosophical nonsense. Things are not just the way they are. And actually that is a statement that if you take it quite seriously, it is one, astonishingly audacious on a level that's kind of jaw-dropping. The Principle of Hope as a book is just, if you think about what he's trying to do, is trying to trace from the smallest phenomenological moments of existence through every aspect of kind of culture is tracing the kind of continuation and perpetuation of these utopian ideals. But things are not just the way they are. There is, what is it that Block says? There is this kind of utopian predicate in the first statement of all great human activity. That's everything from films to dance to music to falling in love to going for a walk. There are these, but that is not enough. That's not, they are simply kind of like, you know, a ruin that's starting to peak above the surface of a wave, right? That's all they are. And our job is to actually kind of work out the structure that you see glimpses of only partly.
And again, I was thinking back to this distinction that helps kind of, again, concretize his notion of the not yet when he's thinking about potency, if you will, in Aristotle, right? This notion of potential. And he devises this terminology, which I don't reproduce here, but that the translators helpfully kind of broke down into this what is considered possible, which would be on the ground today from now, the possibilities we might conceive of it based on the present, you know, conditions versus what may become possible, which already sort of adds this extra dynamic dimension to possibility that could be considered foreclosed or like in a Leibnizian way, like incompossible with the world as it is. And I think that extra dimension, that extra flavor of possibility helped to see, again, just at a glance, philosophically, what he's trying to explore. And perhaps also this kind of interesting dividing line between an Aristotelian right and an Aristotelian left, which I kind of really enjoy because, you know, when I think of like right and left Hegelians, right? But I'd never heard of this like right and left Aristotelians, but I think it makes sense and helps to sort of, again, it helped me to rethink about some concepts. So it had a kind of reverberating effect just reading a small bit of his work. So who knows how much reading even more, right? I've only really dipped my toes in at this point.
And this is the kind of hope of this primer, is that like, it's going to leave people in that exact situation of being like, hey, there's more here. There's more here that I think is worth paying attention to. He writes really well about detective fiction, for example. You know, famously says that only Marxism is both detective and liberator. If you want to understand your conditions, it's only that, only through this commitment to a kind of revolutionary Marxism that you'll understand it and you'll be able to be freer from it. Are there any other particular points you wanted to pick up on?
I know we've hit on some broad topics. We even hit on the non-synchronous, which you brought up with not everyone inhabiting the same now, which I thought was was really, really interesting. And yeah, I like, Coop, that you brought up with me this notion of a Deleuze is always talking about the people to come, right? Which sounds very Blockian, even if he only referenced block once, as I mentioned, John, you know, in the Foucault seminars. But do you want to end with a quote here? One of the quotes that you highlighted, Coop, or?
Yeah, let me find that. There was one that I really enjoyed in particular.
Maybe we can have you read a quote, John, from your book. And I do want to give you space to talk about your other book and for what we might see from you in the future, to anticipate just a little bit. I'll give you the, we always give our guests the floor.
Ah, this is actually what it was.
I've got to be honest, Coop, this is one of maybe my favorite bits of the book as well.
Awesome.
Utopia is made, an open-ended and autopoetic process embodied by the laboring, struggling, dreaming working classes. Throughout so much of Bloch's work, it is the proletariat, the working classes, that are the focus of utopian and revolutionary activity. Those who often have no time or freedom, but that which can be dreamed and fantasized about, are perhaps the most attuned to the latencies and possibilities of the present moment, the short, fleeting glimpses of what the world could be beyond the limits of labor.
We had a guest on last week, my buddy Rocco Gangle, and we talked about autopoiesis. So like when I was like, oh, he said the thing. He said, but no, this was, and right after I had reread that passage this morning, Coop like sent me he was sending me like quotes from the book. It was nice. We're getting hyped up for the discussion.
This is actually a really important point, which is like, Bloch is such a good writer that like, he takes this from Goethe, of this idea of like, everything is always going up. There's always like this feeling of like ascent, and you feel the kind of like rhythm of each concept kind of like build and build and build. And it's this sort of like, his paragraphs are like crescendos, right? If you read them and you don't sort of like feel anything, I sort of wonder if you've been paying attention.
Right.
So he like, his whole point is about kind of intensifying all of these things, which are so often kind of underappreciated or not spoken forcefully enough. And I think maybe that's why some people are a little suspicious, because it's like, it's a sermon, right? It's
right. Okay.
There's something kind of like immensely powerful about it. And like Jameson calls Bloch the closest thing Marxism has to a theologian of revolution. And, you know, for some people, that's a kind of very ambiguous, quite loaded title, but I actually don't think it's a bad one. And it's like, maybe that's worth interrogating and kind of worth taking on. But there is something about it which is, I think if you read some Bloch for the first time and you find yourself kind of like, you can get hyped reading Bloch. The excitement is worth paying attention to. That's a feeling that's worth kind of following.
It's nice when you can read a book or even a passage and, you know, you have to stop and reflect, you know, instead of just consuming, you know. There is I'm kind of thinking of Nietzsche, where he's talking about learning to ruminate, right? There's so often we have to train ourselves to like learn how to sort of digest what's been fed in these insights. And yeah, and perhaps that's part of it, because it does lead to a crescendo. It needs to be done in small bits. Otherwise one might get a little overwhelmed, or might not process it. Right. As you were saying, sometimes I it can happen where I'm doing like a kind of dead read where the words are sort of cycling through, but nothing's processing. It's like fucking hamster in a wheel or something. So and then I have to like stop myself and be like, okay, I gotta reread. Where's my brain? Turn it on. But I mentioned, I wanted to give you space, John, to tell us more, if you will, about the other book that you mentioned. You can obviously restate the title and tell us a little bit more about that, and maybe when it's coming out. And is the primer now out, or is it coming out this week?
I'm not sure when this episode will be dropping, but
3 weeks from now. So it will have been.
It will available. Have been. Yes.
Yes. Okay.
This will be out by the time this is in your ears. So A Primer on Utopian Philosophy, an Introduction to the Work of Ernst Bloch, is out, not yet, but now, from Zero Books. It is part of their excellent series of short interventions into the question of utopia, trying to kind of push for a reappraisal of utopian philosophy. There have been some great books in the series so far, one on pessimism in contemporary culture, one on degrowth and eco-socialism, one on the contradictions of utopia in Adorno and the radical black tradition. And now this introduction to Ernst Bloch. My next book, which will be out in July, is called Capitalism, a Horror Story, Gothic Marxism and the Dark Side of the Radical Imagination, and is about trying to bring together this Blochian utopianism and a Marxist philosophy of history with cultural criticism, and trying to argue for horror as not only a site that allows us to understand contemporary capitalism and the phenomenological cultural experience of what it's like to live through that, but also that within horror you can find ground for these questions of the future and actually what happens after the horror ends, and how do we learn to live with and thrive in the monstrosity that is forced upon us. So that's out July 9th, I believe, from Repeater Books. And then next, I think, is there's still more work to do with Bloch, I think. And something that I think I'd quite like to write next is something that is kind of bringing Benjamin and Bloch into closer dialogue. This is a very common, very well accepted part of their philosophy, but I think it's kind of neglected a little bit now. Bloch really appreciated Benjamin's Arcades project. This kind of Another massive book. This great kind of gothic ruin of philosophy that, had it been completed, you know, would have been one of the great statements of philosophical aesthetics in the 20th century, but is even in its is perfectly complete in its incompleteness. And I think there's some really interesting work to do to draw these two thinkers, you know, the messianic kind of pessimist and the messianic prophetic revolutionary, into some really interesting dialogue. So that's provisionally what I'm working on next. But the Capitalism Horror Story will be the next thing out in the world.
That's great. And everybody go listen to
Horror Vanguard. Come on.
Horror Vanguard. I was going to call it Vanguard Horror. I was like, that's not fucking right. Horror Vanguard. Jesus. Yeah. But no.
Everybody... Speaking of heretics.
Yeah, right. I mean.
Yeah, please check out the show. Please, if you like talking about movies, if you like talking about ideas, and if you like, you know, movies about terrifying monsters that going to destroy us all, then Horror Vanguard will be a podcast I think that you'll really dig.
Awesome. Well, John, thank you so much for spending time with us today. We're going to stay on just for a minute to talk about next week's episode, but we'll be in touch. Obviously, it was a real pleasure getting to read your work, and thank you for introducing us to Ernst Bloch's work.
Thank you so much for having me on, and let's do this again sometime.
Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Once again, thanks to John, the Lit Crit guy, for joining Taylor and I on this week's edition of the Machinic Unconscious Happy Hour.
The very rules of evil, of negativity and singularity, including the ultimate form of singularity, which is unconscious. To the whole state of things, in pure violence without object and form. This is the typical violence of information. It's violent because what happens there is a murder of the real, the vanishing point of reality.
Let's not have a misunderstanding here.
With nothing left but recycled, whitewashed, lobotomized people, as in Blockwork Orange.